This is a CNA podcast.
This is Heart of the Matter, and I'm Lin Su Ling. Thanks for tuning in after we took a two-week break to focus on our GE 2020 coverage. And boy, was it an election for the history books. Held in the midst of a pandemic, the heat of the hustings went online with e-rallies, political broadcasts, and Zoom press conferences. During the nine-day campaigning, the opposition warned of a possible wipeout, while the PAP asked for a mandate to deal with a world upended by COVID-19. And on Saturday morning, Singapore awoke to find the People's Action Party government firmly in power with 83 seats, but with a significant drop in their vote share and the loss of Sengkang to the Workers' Party. What do the results reveal about what Singaporeans want out of their government? How should the PAP interpret the results and govern going forward? And what does it say about the Workers' Party and other opposition parties in Singapore? Joining us to discuss these issues are political scientist Dr. Lam Peng Er.
Hello, everyone.
And of course, frequent guest on this podcast, Deputy Director of the Institute of Policy Studies, Gillian Koh.
Hi, Su Ling. Hi, everyone.
So let's just start, I suppose, at the beginning. When you saw the top line results on Friday night, Saturday morning, what was your immediate reaction? What were your top line takeaways?
I think this election is really interesting. I would brand it as a Singapore's new normal because I think with hindsight, 2015 was an anomaly. The demise of Mr. Lee Kuan Yew, our founding father, and the sense of pride and nationalism and joy due to the Golden Jubilee, 50th anniversary of Singapore's foundation as a sovereign state. So I think those two factors were the two big drivers for the PAP's fabulous results, winning 69.9%. In this general election, it is just a shade better than how the PAP performed in 2011. Basically, I would argue that it is a new normal. 2015 was an anomaly, and I would call it a Goldilocks election for Singaporeans.
Do you share those views, Gillian? I think it's great to bring Gillian in here right now. Was it about the national mood?
Well, let me just first share with you the highlights for me. One, clearly the swing of 8.7% away from the PAP. We'd expected a flight to safety. For me, I thought that the mark would indeed be closer to 2015 because this was a crisis election. And we remember the sort of shock and awe packages to respond to COVID, something to the order of 92.9 billion dollars, 72 billion of it directed at jobs. So that was quite surprising for me. The second surprise, of course, WP taking Sengkang. That's a team that came out of the blue, apart from He Ting Ru, who'd faced an election earlier in 2015. The rest were really fresh faces. And that rested Sengkang from a team that the PAP fielded that featured three office holders. The final point is this. When you look at the margins, I was surprised at how close it was in West Coast. West Coast GRC faced off a new party, Progress Singapore Party, and we were looking for how strong a showing this new party would be. Granted, they had Tan Cheng Bock, who was returning to his old stomping ground, Ayer Rajah, but Ayer Rajah was but one tiny bit of the whole of the GRC. But back to margins, where Heng Swee Keat stood as a surprise candidate in East Coast, the margin was slightly better than West Coast, but not very generous either, margin of about 6.8 percentage points. And related to that, I think when you look at finally the standing or the pecking order of margins held by the 4G leaders of the PAP, then the best performers were, listen to this, Sembawang's Ong Ye Kung, and that won by a margin of almost 36%. Then you had Masagos Zulkifli, who didn't have Heng Swee Keat as his fellow anchor in Tampines, a margin of 33%. Then let me read out the rest. Then it's next is Josephine Teo in Jalan Besar, then Lawrence Wong in Marsiling UT, and then Chan Chun Sing in Tanjung Pagar GRC.
So a lot of surprises and differences, and even within the SMC, some did really well. But I just want to go back and drill down into Sengkang since you brought it up.
Yes.
What was it that happened in Sengkang? You know, they had three political office holders there sent by the PAP, mm-hmm. though it was a new GRC. What do you take away from the strategies that were employed there and what didn't work?
Sengkang is a new constituency, so it was a more level playing field for the WP and the PAP. in Sengkang, the bastion of WP support is Punggol East. In fact, they have captured Punggol East since the by-election when the Speaker of the House, Michael Palmer, stood down. And Charles Chong of the PAP captured Punggol East, but the skin of his teeth, Charles Chong, you know, skin of his teeth in 2115. If not for the Golden Jubilee, and if not for Mr. Lee Kuan Yew's demise as a founding father, Workers' Party would have comfortably retained Punggol East. So the Workers' Party already has a local fortress in Sengkang. And you look at the team, they have a charmer, James Lim, a very likable, very charming, who stood his ground. And in the eyes of many Singaporeans, they thought that he was the best performer at the first national debate.
So this is really funny because this goes back to the conversation you and I, Gillian, were having about previously, was there this star power effect? And, you know, mm-hmm. we thought about Nicole Seah, and she was there in 2011, she had star power, or even Chen Shao-mao. Do you think that was still valid this election, the James Lim effect?
Actually, it was surprising, but over the course of the hustings, you did see that James Lim became the new Nicole Seah or the Chen Shao-mao, yes. right? That came off the TV debate where he sort of, so to speak, stood eye to eye with the party heavyweight.
With Vivian Balakrishnan, who's actually a great debater. That's, and he came across as very believable and likable. Right.
And then the second one is Reisha Khan. I think a lot of the younger voters, the millennials, would really identify with her, a social entrepreneur. Her background, she is working with Rohingya refugees, and that sense of humanitarian concerns really appeal to the younger voters. But please remember that she's also the daughter of Farid Khan, who tried to contest in the last presidential election, and the huge baggage that comes with the identification with Farid Khan.
Yeah, Daddy was the president of the Malay Business Federation. And James was not the only star in that slate of candidates. I think Miss He Ting Lu got a law degree from abroad, did natural sciences at Cambridge. She came across as very likable and very believable. So
and
it's not just a one-man
that's not
show.
Enough, then you had a very steady, sensible Louis Chow, who is also a professional in the finance sector. But I think the most important point is this, and you mentioned, Su Ling, that it was a COVID election. With all the restrictions, I think so much of the campaign had to be online. But also there was the provision, wasn't there, of the constituency political broadcasts. And that gave the team from Sengkang the opportunity to really nail their identity as young people with young families that then were similar to the voters in the main, in the Sengkang area, where you see there are many young families. And they said, we understand, we share
they have
the same
resonance,
journey.
Can
in
relate.
That's right.
They can relate to voters, voters can relate to them.
That's right.
So was it really about personalities? Because
no,
you've talked so much about
the
personalities
the point,
of parties.
Yeah, there's personalities and identification with the candidates, but also the candidates in Sengkang emphasised that they were like insiders. They knew exactly what residents felt needed to be addressed in the estate. Right, they were talking about the lack of mom and pop shops, kopitiam, you know, gathering, watering holes, local watering holes for the residents, the shopping facilities, and also facilities for the kids. Although we know over the years, the PAP sort of built up the childcare centre facilities in that general vicinity. But I think the candidates were saying, we know your pain and we are going to address those. So I think two things. One, identification with the demographic part, but also saying we are insiders, you know, trying to present that. And I think that's WP. WP had its candidates go out with the national messages, but also in the case of the Sengkang team, allowed the Sengkang team to develop a very local identity through the hustings.
So is it really about local issues and what residents feel is lacking in their local amenities?
Let's push it up to the national level. And I think that the message that the WP was putting out, remember we talked about the flight to safety because of the COVID election, then the WP's counter deny
a blank check.
Give PAP a blank check. And so instead of the 2015 scare of the PAP chairman at that time, you wake up one morning the PAP is no longer government. This time around,
the scare is the wipeout of the opposition, losing Aljunied and keeping only Hougang.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I think that really worked to the advantage of the opposition parties. Huh?
Yeah. Especially to WP. Mm-hmm. The other opposition parties, I think, built their campaign around foreigners, foreigners, foreigners. So we know the facts about whether the PAP government has the 10 million population target. We know the facts about that. But I think in the discussion, it already sort of reminded voters that there is that immigration issue that we have to discuss. So foreigners. Then the second foreigner bit was really about the management of COVID. And you saw the PSP saying that it did not feel that had been managed well, and now it's sort of caused Singapore to be set back in terms of travel bans against Singaporeans going out, business travel and all that. Although we know also that the government was the first to be able to establish a green lane with China. So I think at the national level, there were those issues that the opposition parties brought up. And so foreigners, foreigners, foreigners again became a leitmotif of GE 2020.
Gillian, were you stunned when we look at the results at East Coast? The presumptive Prime Minister, Heng Swee Keat, the Prime Minister in waiting, was moved from Tampines, probably at the 11th hour, to East Coast. And then the result was around 53%.
You sound surprised.
Personally, I suspect that if Heng Swee Keat was not moved to the East Coast, the PAP might well have lost the East Coast. That could be one scenario if they didn't move Swee Keat from Tampines to East Coast. And could you imagine the consternation among many PAP supporters and the ruling party if they had not only lost Sengkang, but also East Coast?
Of course, we know that East Coast GRC of 2020 is different from East Coast of 2015. But remember, it is now an agglomeration of East Coast GRC of 2015, which was one of the slimmest margins, though not very slim. Mm. The PAP took it by 60.73%. It includes also Fengshan, which the PAP took with a figure of 57.52. What am I getting at? Put them together, the average then would have been close to 60%. But we know that there's a swing this time around of 8.7%. So that would actually bring it quite close, very, very slim. And so actually, if you take it that way, then Heng Swee Keat did a little bit better than would have expected if nothing changed.
Gillian, if Swee Keat had not moved from Tampines to East Coast, do you think that might have been a possibility they would have lost East Coast?
Lim Swee Say and Lim Yi Shen have stood down for such a long time.
Yes.
It's not possible that the PAP did not have a plan. It feels the ground. It sets the time for the election. It decides where the candidates should be. So it's only just a tactical thing to surprise everyone, and sort of Heng Swee Keat saying, you know, I have the courage to move. And Tampines did very, very well.
Yeah.
So he's built up a team there.
Against a weaker opposition party, yeah?
Well, certainly, but then he's built up a team and he's saying, I'm man enough to leave there because I've got Masakos Zulkifli there and go to East Coast. Yeah. And this is well planned because actually, Pinger, you might have seen screenshots of the nomination papers for Tampines were all typewritten. So that was already planned. And East Coast was just one little spot that was handwritten with Heng Swee Keat's name there. So I think it was all planned. And Heng Swee Keat probably saying, I'm the presumptive leader, as you said.
Yes.
And I've got to show that I've got the courage and I will take responsibility to ensure that East Coast does not fall. And that was the case. But of course, WP also had its surprise that Nicole Siah was swung out to East Coast rather than Marine Parade, which she had contested in 2011. So I think it was quite important that Heng Swee Keat had gone there.
Yes.
It's a good performance for him in an area that was potentially quite weak.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about what next. I mean, I think we talked a lot about the opposition and the PAP, so maybe let's get into first the opposition parties. Across the board, seems to be a lot of the parties made inroads, some more than others. And what would you read from the WP getting into power and also a higher vote share for the PSP or the SCP even?
I think the Workers' Party will have to run the town councils very, very well. Not only in Aljunied, but also in Sengkang. You know, that I think was the Achilles heel of the Workers' Party. We have to bear in mind that there's an ongoing court case. The Workers' Party had appealed. So it's an ongoing process. This is a sort of Damocles on the head of the...
Printlong?
Sylvia.
Sylvia Lim.
And Sylvia. So the Sengkang team really has to pull up their socks and to do really well, transparent, clean accounts.
But what do you make of Pritam Singh being designated leader of the opposition? What does that mean?
This is the norm of parliamentary democracy. We inherited the British system, and it's quite routine in Australia, New Zealand, Canada,
United Kingdom. What are the implications
of that for
the opposition going
forward? The leader of the largest opposition as the Her Majesty's loyal opposition. In Singapore, in East Asia, there is this cultural norm, historical norm. You think opposition is disloyal because you oppose, you undermine the ruling party. And I remember many decades ago, then PAP Foreign Minister Rajaratnam said, oh, the role of the opposition in Singapore is to undermine the ruling party, is to make bad government. So I think the whole country, we have to change our mindset because we are in the same boat. So whether you are opposition, you're the ruling party, I think we should all, when the chips are down, like COVID-19 and so on, we should really pull in the right direction. We roll together. It doesn't matter whether you're wearing white or wearing blue, we should roll together. Yeah. But I think it's the right direction. I think PM did the right thing. That was a gracious move on his part, not to marginalise. But it's part of the maturation, the development of Singapore politics.
To emphasize the point, in a Westminster system where there is a two-party system, then you have the leader of the opposition presumably being the head of a shadow cabinet, shadow government. But of course, WP only has 10. And government in Singapore today is far more complex and you need far more people. But at least what it does is it makes it a structure. It makes it a permanent institution to have an opposition in parliament rather than thinking that the PAP would one day win all seats and that the opposition is just marginal. But the second point is this, that the leader of the opposition provides a face to Singapore's democracy. So when you have visiting foreign dignitaries, it's the tradition that they would want to, of course, speak to government leaders, but they will always take a nod at who is the leader of the opposition to try and understand that side of the house and what are the issues that the alternative policies and alternative policy standpoints that the opposition has. And I think it's really interesting because there's a provision for 12 opposition voices in parliament. It seems to be that the PAP is actually trying to move towards normalizing the presence of opposition and imagine PSP is having its meeting this morning because it's got the offer of 2 NCMP seats. But of course, the leader of the opposition needs to organize that agenda a bit more. But then it really then gives us that flavor of diversity in Singapore's political landscape in a formal way.
Yeah. Gillian, talking about Singapore's political landscape, I'm very heartened to note that the leader of the largest opposition party in parliament is an ethnic Indian. That's wonderful, right? And then our president is a Malay minority. And you look at Aljunied, a slate of 5. And 3 out of 5 are ethnic minorities. And you look at Singapore's composition, 76% of ethnic Chinese origins. And yet we have a political system.
It's subtle in the way that that issue emerged.
Yeah, it's a multicultural,
multi-ethnic system. Because another theme of GE20... Mm-hmm. 20 was who is not prepared for a non-Chinese PM?
Yeah.
And I think that is something that is going to be quite 5 years down the road. Yeah. We'll remember that was one topic. So Singaporeans prepared to have minorities lead them. Yeah. And let's look at the best performer of GE 2020, Jurong GRC, that's helmed by Senior Minister Tharman Shanmugaratnam. You saw the PAP give him the platform 2 days before polling day, and there he was taking on the specific policy points that the opposition raised. GST, minimum wage, unemployment benefits, and so on. So the PAP's got a good thing going, as well as the opposition. But the bottom line is this, Singapore has a good thing going.
Yeah,
I think this diversity is very valuable, and I reinforce Pinga's point about the maturation of our polity.
So I want to shift gears a little bit into the PAP and what this means for the PAP and how they should interpret the results going forward. I think more importantly also, PM had come out to say during his E-Fullerton rally that he would lead the COVID response with the 2 SMs and the 4G. What do you interpret from that?
There's continuity and change. continuity and change. And that is what PAP does. It doesn't make major shifts. I think even in 13 Parliament, you saw cabinets which are a bit of a half step here, half step there. So I think, you know, Singaporeans do want the comfort of knowing 3G is there while 4G is being built up. That's quite important. WPU is quite radical because suddenly we heard that Lau Tia Kiang was no longer there. People thought it was a big surprise, but actually Lau Tia Kiang had already passed the baton over in 2018 to Pritam. Mm. And there he was again in the campaign. There was a little bit of scare when the WP did not send a Chinese-speaking candidate to the first Mandarin debate. And, you know, everybody was wondering whether they had now forsaken their Chinese ground. But I think they came back and they recovered quite well. So continuity with change, yeah. I think is...
In a way, I think 2020 was a victory lap for former MP Lau Tia Kiang. He did something which JBJ and Chiam See Tong did not do. He actually built a team. That was a smooth passing on the baton. And for the WP to win Sengkang, I think that was a vindication of his strategy.
I really want to go back into looking at succession across the aisle for the PAP, especially what you think this bodes for the PAP, given that so many of the 4G ministers are now helming their own GRCs. This is their first election. What do you think the results
bode? Well, as I said, in terms of the margins, outlook? The best performer was Ong Ye Kung, and then Masa Goss and Joe Teo, Lawrence Wong.
And Chan what are the implications of that?
I think that
electoral results, the
4G leadership is still being built up, and you've got to see that these results do matter. And I think there'll be some rethinking. The PAP has also said that. But the Secretary General said he regrets seeing that key members of his 4G leadership, Ng Chee Meng, Amrin Amin, whom he really put the spotlight on in 2015, no longer there. Lam Pin Min, who is a senior minister of state for health and transport, no longer there. Who's going to be the new transport minister? Who would dare to
Jillian,
take that up?
And what are the implications for the cabinet, the next cabinet, where there are many positions to be filled?
Well, my takeaway from this election is the wave of the future is already now. The future is already now. The millennials. I think the Workers' Party would not have won Sengkang if not for the millennials. They think somewhat different, you know. Mm-hmm. And they did not respond with that much of a consternation when Ms. Reza Khan made her comments on ethnicity and so on. But older Singaporeans, I think, tend to be very, very wary and sensitive about ethnic issues. You know?
Do you have any parting shots for our viewers to take away?
Since I think the difficulty is in picking what would be the parting shot. There's so much to say, as you said, Sulin. But I think we're looking at a situation which is good for democracy. We now have a better balance in Parliament, but the development of Progress Singapore Party, SDP doing better. And so we have now a good group of opposition parties that hopefully with GE 2020 gains momentum in terms of presenting coherent, cogent, alternative views on public policy issues that really matter. Housing, transportation, healthcare has been managed quite well, I reckon. Education, we've seen a lot of reforms. What other areas do we see there's need for fresh ideas? I think social support is key. In the PAP, Lee Hsien Loong's speech in the national broadcast, he had said that he recognised that there's going to be a need to strengthen social safety nets. Though a lot had been done, there's still a lot of insecurity that Singaporeans have, so we can probably look forward to an agenda which includes interesting ideas on how to do retirement, unemployment, CPF reforms. Yeah.
The PAP, Workers' Party and other opposition parties, they have to win the hearts and minds of the millennials. My parting comment is that, to me, this was a Goldilocks election. You scratch your head and wonder, oh, hey, what is this guy talking Goldilocks election? Goldilocks and three bears. Porridge was neither too hot nor too cold. The bed was neither too hard or not too soft, but just nice. And for a majority of Singapore voters, I think they slept very well. On the 11th, early wee hours of July.
After the PAP post-election.
Why is that so? Why it is like a sweet spot for a majority of Singapore voters? Why Goldilocks? Because the PAP is back in power. It has a strong mandate. By global standards, you win anything above 60%. It is a strong
mandate. They have 90% of the seats in parliament.
Yes, it is a strong mandate. And at the same time, the opposition parties were not wiped out in parliament. And they didn't have to come in through the back door, through NCMP. And the Workers' Party captured Sengkang. So I think this is actually a very, very good development for Singapore democracy. So we, the voters, have the had a cake and eat it too. They have a PAP government, and then they have the opposition in parliament. And this is our system of checks and balances. So good luck to both the ruling party. May they do well governing the country. And I hope Pritam and his team will be a good and loyal opposition that we all pull together after Hastings in the same direction. And there will be more crises confronting Singapore and ASEAN in the years ahead. The geopolitics, disruption of supply chains, technology. So, yeah, majulah Singapura.
Well, thank you, Peng and Julian. Some very sharp insights there. Yeah. Electrifying election, a Goldilocks election. I learned something new today.
Yes.
Thanks for coming today to our podcast. Heart of the Matter is brought to you by Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and our research writer, Erin Low, as well. And I'm Lin Su Ling, signing off. Thank you.